This is Northwest Reports. I'm Aliha Sayed. Today, we're talking to Liz Giordano about what it was like to report on an alleged labor trafficking case that left 24 Filipino fishermen stranded at the Westport Marina. The men were working on contract for McAdams Fish, a California-based company, when they encountered a slow season. The company decided to dock the boats in September, and because none of the fishermen had visas, they risked a fine if they stepped off the vessels, making them entirely dependent on McAdams to return home and for basic needs like food. The men eventually spent 3 months stuck on these boats. During this time, they didn't receive a majority of their pay. In this episode, we talk with Liz, who collaborated with Farah El-Tohemi and Jalen Grisso to tell this story, about what it was like to meet the fishermen in person, the trip they took to Westport to see where these men were stranded for so long, and the tip that led them to this story in the first place. Could you tell me, before we get into kind of the behind the scenes and the process of reporting the story, just what the story is about?
Yeah, we got a tip about about 24 Filipino men living on boats at the Westport Marina last winter. It kind of unraveled a story about these men who are missing paychecks, and then also then, because of a lack of visa, felt that they were stranded at the Westport Marina kind of between seasons by this fishing company they had been hired to work for. And so this became this complicated story we unraveled about the men missing wages and then also not being able to leave and go home because of this lack of visa they had. And so it just became this interesting story that we delved into, like, the personal life of some of the men and then also kind of the situation that they find themselves in as foreign fishermen. So it's not required for these fishermen working on U.S. vessels to have a visa. So that meant that they couldn't leave the boat. And these boats are not huge boats, like these huge container ship boats. These are small fishing boats that, you know, usually have crews of 3 to 4. And so it's about, most of these boats are about the size of like 5 parking spaces. And technically, these men weren't allowed off the boats onto the dock. In past years, it seems that the men were allowed a little bit more leeway. They were allowed to get off onto the dock and off into other boats and then allowed to use the marina bathroom. But how it's explained to us is a change in leadership by the Customs and Border Patrol that now the men were just confined to their own boats. And some men had like 2 or 3 other crewmates that were there with them that they would eat with and exercise with and pass the time with. And some men were just there by themselves. They communicated sometimes over the radio and sometimes they shouted across the boats. But some men had very little interaction with other people for these 3 months they were there.
And this was, you said, September through December?
Yeah, late September through late December.
And when the story came to you and your editor, did y'all have a moment to kind of think about it and say, should we pursue this? Or was it kind of, when you got the tip, was it sort of clear that you were going to cover this?
It was pretty clear because it was such an unusual story. You know, you don't hear about it very often. And then at first when we dug into it, it was just like this mix of, you know, these fishermen missing wages, but also in this like really interesting, murky situation without a U.S. documentation of any sort. And so kind of just exploring both of those is kind of like, how do you protect, you know, these fishermen that are working on U.S. boats with current U.S. labor laws, but then they weren't really here because they didn't have papers. And so it's kind of this interesting kind of dilemma of like, who's accountable to like make sure these people are being paid and then also treated well too, that making sure they had enough food and water, but then in this interesting situation about not being able to leave the boats and, you know, advocate for themselves or go find help or, you know, even ask people if is this an okay situation.
And what they were experiencing, is that kind of something that falls under the definition of labor trafficking?
One of the definitions is this like coercion by threat. Keeping them there is one of the definitions of labor trafficking. And so they had this threat of a large fine that would come if they did leave because, again, of their lack of visa. And so, yeah, that's one definition of labor trafficking.
Yeah, well, like you said, it's unusual. What was it like delving into it? Like, how did you get started?
Yeah, like any good story, it came from a tip. And this one came from the Filipino community that has rallied and gathered around these men. A lot of the Filipino community are fishermen and, you know, they love the water, they love the ocean, they love Westport. And to find out that it's happening to find the situation happening in their backyard, for a lot of it, was very disheartening.
And the story has so many, like you said, just so many moving parts, and there's so many people. But who were some of the people that you spoke to for this story to understand what was happening?
Yeah, we spoke to six of the 24 men that remained that decided to stay and kind of be part of the investigation that's happening about the labor trafficking and their wages. We talked to numerous people in the Filipino community, some of them that lead advocacy organizations, some of them are just part of the Filipino American community. We talked to an advocate for seafarers who usually works with seafarers on big cargo ships. We talked to, who else we talked to? We reached out to all of the U.S. agencies that might have a jurisdiction over this. You know, we talked to Homeland Security and the Coast Guard and the U.S. Attorney's Office. And yeah, we even talked to one of the fishermen's wife a little bit to kind of have that impact back home just a little bit as they video chatted. It was really interesting to getting to know some of the men kind of on a personal level, too.
Well, when we were in the office, like I was here, I think a month ago is when a couple of the fishermen actually came into the office to interview in person, and there was an interpreter on site. What's the purpose of that, like having people come in person to sit and talk about their stories? Like, what's the value of that versus chatting virtually?
Yeah, it's a very personal story the men were telling, about feeling stranded and abandoned and not knowing what was going to happen. And I always want to do these interviews in person, you know, like these very personal stories to make sure the person knows that I'm giving them the time and attention it deserves. And also just, you know, you can't build a relationship like that over the phone. We wanted an interpreter. A lot of these men spoke very good English, but we wanted them to feel comfortable explaining their situation in a language that they're very comfortable in. So they didn't have to think about how to tell their story and which English word to use. So they could just explain it how they're most comfortable. And so that was really important to do. And then we needed to do that in person because it's a lot of moving parts. It's a lot of people. And also bringing the men in is they got to meet me, too. It's a lot to tell somebody your story, especially somebody you don't know, and trust them that they're going to correctly tell their story, you know, or just to show the men like how important it was for us to tell their story and how important we thought the story was to get out there, to show up in time. And it wasn't the first time we met with the men. We met with them a week prior just to get to know them, to get a little bit more background information on them, and then also for them to meet us again to kind of start building that trust as we go into like the deeper interview and we, you know, talk more about their personal lives and kind of what happened through this very difficult and stressful time they went through.
Yeah, and in this story, like, there's so much going on and it required a lot of investment. And you also reported on it with two other journalists who are also on the investigative team. Why did y'all collaborate on this story? Why was it important to have a couple of people covering this?
Well, I think Cascade PBS just thought it was a really great story and they wanted, not a really great story, but an important story. They wanted to tell it on a lot of different levels. You know, they wanted a video component, and so that's why Jalen was involved. And then obviously the written component, our desk does, the investigative desk does that. And so I think just to be able to wrap our heads around how big this story and how complicated it was, it's nice to have another reporter working with you, you know, bounce ideas off of, to do a little bit of the reporting on their own or a little bit of the research on their own, and just to make sure we're getting it all right, because it's also a story we wanted to get out there pretty quickly just to have it out there, because it's, again, it's an important story to tell, kind of this like where these men are, and especially as the new fishing season's coming, like it's going to start next month. And so, you know, is this just going to be the same cycle over and over, where we're going to have another group of 24 Filipino men living on boats at the whim of their employer, or is something going to change, or is, you know, are we going to be able to see something different happen?
And did all three of you, so you, Farah, and Jalen, did you all go to Westport together?
Yeah, we all went to Westport together.
When did you do that?
Early March we went.
What was that experience like, and why did you go?
Oh, I think it was important to write the story to kind of know where these men were for so long, because this is their big experience, right? This is where they were stranded and felt abandoned for so long. And so just to give us some context, what was it like? You know, exactly how big are these boats? You know, we heard they weren't huge, but it's different when you actually go there and you see how small they are, and then how much of the boat is already taken up with fishing equipment. So how much livable space is there? And then you think about the winter. These men are from a very different climate, and so they weren't outside on the boat exposed all winter, right? right? I wouldn't be. And so just the idea of being able to kind of put yourself in their shoes and see kind of where they spent all this time. Like, what were they doing with this time? What could they see from their boats? What could they hear? And so I think it was important to put ourselves in that kind of context, kind of immerse ourselves as much as possible.
You know, that's something, it was apparent to me just in this story, is these are all individuals who are vulnerable on so many fronts. They're in a new country. There are some language barriers. What was it like kind of starting the reporting process and acknowledging all of these factors? You know, how did you navigate this with sensitivity? What did some of those conversations look like between you and the reporters, you and your editor?
Yeah, I think the first thing was, like, we knew from the outset that we needed an interpreter. You know, we needed to make sure that we were getting their story straight and the way they were explaining it, to make sure we weren't missing any nuances as they speak in a language that's not their first language. So that was the first thing. We wanted to also be extra careful about identifying where they're living now. You know, they're in Seattle, but we didn't want to give the exact address or, you know, any identifying locations. The men also, some of the men weren't comfortable with us, like, coming over to their house. And so we wanted to respect that because, like, they're giving us their story, but then they also needed to protect themselves. So I think just, like, making sure we knew the guidelines and kind of what made them feel most comfortable was important. I think one thing kind of going after this story is making sure we follow their story, not just, like, get the splashy headline story, but, like, kind of where does it go from here, I think is important, you know, because this is a long road ahead of them they have. And it's also kind of understanding how trafficking cases work and, like, what's at risk for them. Are they going to be able to, if they go home, would another staffing agency hire them to work again? Are they going to be able to find work and support themselves? A lot of them have young families. And so, again, one important thing to do is follow the story to the end.
Are there plans to continue reporting in the immediate future? Are you going to keep tabs on what's going on and potentially report more?
Yeah, that we'd like to. We're all thinking kind of, like, what other stories we can tell, especially with the upcoming fishing season. So kind of thinking about what can we follow and what can we still report and investigate on.
Getting really deep into these investigations about people's lives, I'd imagine that raises a lot of emotions. I just wonder what it's like navigating those. Like, did anything come up for you while you were reporting this story?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think you can't help but just feel emotional and empathetic to these men. The man who became one of our main characters, his wife had a baby while he was gone. And if my husband was gone, like, and not having that help, that was just really sad. And, you know, I kept thinking about all the firsts he's going to miss with his son, you know, his first smile, his first laugh, rolling over, or even changing a diaper, or just being able to, like, have that touch or that caress. It's like, it's not the same over the phone. And how is his son going to know him? That's just really sad, especially because the first year is such a special time. So that really hit home, and kind of all he's missing. And also because of all he's missing, because of this fight he wants to take up to make sure that fishermen aren't put in this position in the future. To me, that's, like, that's amazing, and also giving up so much. So that was really relatable to me and sad.
Yeah. How do you navigate some of that, like, when you're reporting on something that's particularly heavy?
I just remember how important it is to kind of, again, get that story out and tell people what's going on. Just knowing that people are going to read a story about this and read my story and kind of hopefully take away the same things I took away.
Were there any things that were unexpected? Like, when you were reporting on this and you, Jalen, and Farah were talking about the story developing and unfolding before your eyes, were there things that came up or kind of took you in a different direction?
I wouldn't say different direction, but again, like, the fact that these men didn't need a visa was just really surprising to me. You know, you hear a lot of, like, agricultural workers coming in and they need their visas and all that. And how's this, I don't want to say loophole, but there's just, like, this hole in, like, U.S. law that kind of leaves these men open for exploitation because of this lack of visa. That was really surprising to me. And then, again, living in the Pacific Northwest, I eat a lot of fish. I eat a lot of sushi. You know, I never really thought about where does my fish come from and who's catching it and how is it caught. And so that was really eye-opening, too, that even, you know, these stories that I report on and these men that are not living that far away from me are supplying the fish I eat and kind of what it takes for these men to do that. Like, it's got to be hard to be separated from your family, you know, 9 months out of the year or most of the year. Also, what surprised me is how tight-knit the Filipino-American community is here. They all seem to fish, and they all seem to know each other in a sense. And they really rallied for these men, and they're supporting their legal fight, and they're supporting their living situation, making sure they're comfortable here. And so it was really fun to see just kind of how that community rallied around them.
Is that how you got in contact with the fishermen?
Yeah, somebody reached out. It was a Filipino-American writer who reached out to Crosscut, who I guess they reached out to her, and she's like, well, I don't really do that kind of writing, but let me help you find somebody. And so that's how it happened. And you're like, and like, I think people are always surprised that stories start with a tip, but a lot of stories start with a tip, you know?
And you named a bunch of agencies that were involved or that you spoke to for this story. What was it like navigating all of those and trying to sort of go through all of the bureaucracy on top of telling these men's stories?
That was one of the hard parts, is trying to get the verification that there was some sort of investigation happening. You know, just emailing all these agencies and talking to all their PR people. It was difficult. I didn't get a lot of response. Maybe then in the end it was easy. I don't know. I did get my first I cannot confirm or deny email, which I think is a rite of passage for a lot of journalists. And so that was interesting. But I think we ended up being able to verify it through some documents we have. But yeah, it was hard to kind of keep going and be like, is there an investigation? Is there something going on? Like, what are we seeing that like other people aren't? And so that was really hard. But I think having that verification helped. And then also we were able to talk to the lawyer of the fishing company, and they told us some stuff, and then the men told us some stuff. And so we were kind of able to piece some stuff together and I think have some good verification, and then the documents that we were able to obtain.
And the story itself, I mean, it's long. There's a lot in there. Readers are going to be able to glean a lot from it. But was there anything that didn't make it in that you were originally planning to put in or maybe just decided wouldn't fit?
Oh, a lot didn't go in. I mean, it's already longer than I wanted it to be. So I hope people read it. Hope people stick through the end. But there's always stuff that we can't fit in. And there's always like nuances, like, you know, there's a dispute over, were they going to be paid according to the contract, or this other way that the fishing company often pays men because they usually end up making more money especially if it's a good season. And so it's just like, it is a very important part of the job is to distill it down. What is important? What does the reader really need to know? And so a ton never makes it in. And then like a lot of it's wonky too. And a lot of it's like, I don't know how to go into it and explain it, you know, without losing readers. That's one of the hardest parts, is to write short and to write, you know, distill it down and to make it sure this is just what the reader needs to know. But that's very difficult.
Is there anything, looking back on the past month plus that you've been reporting on it, is there anything that you would have done differently with the story?
I wish I had more time to spend with the men, just to get to know them more personally, get to know about their families. That would have been nice, just to get them to know them outside of this whole situation, because they're more than this.
Thanks for listening to Northwest Reports. This episode was reported by Liz Giordano, Jalen Grisso, and Farah El-Tohemi. It was produced by me, Maliha Sayed, and Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. The story editor was Ryan Familiner. Our executive producer is Sarah Menzies. You can subscribe to Northwest Reports wherever you listen. And whatever platform you're listening on, please review us. We'd love to know what you think of the show. Also, if you would like to support the work we do at Cascade PBS, whether it's our lineup of podcasts, the video docuseries we stream every week, or the in-depth reporting we deliver every day, go to crosscut.com/membership. In addition to supporting our journalism, members receive complete access to the on-demand programming of Cascade PBS. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. That's also where you'll find the story we discussed today. Northwest Reports is a product of Cascade PBS. I'm Maliha Sayed. We'll be back soon with another episode.